Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Shit Show with J-Bo. This is your host, J-Bo. It is late at night on a Monday night, I believe. I've been trying to put out 52 podcasts in a row. That's an entire year. This is number 7. I hope you enjoy these podcasts. I've certainly enjoyed them. It's giving me a reason to get back into podcasting. I had done a whole bunch of interviews, mainly over the past year. They were concerning Los Angeles art rock. I did something with Calvin Johnson. He's like the man in Olympia, Washington. I did some traveling. Anyway, I just want to put out a bunch of cool podcasts. And I heard from the captain that the key to being a successful podcaster is being constant. Every week, at least once a week. There are people like Adam Carolla or Ben Shapiro or... Sorry, I'm going to shut that off because that's loud as shit. And that's my girlfriend. She'll hear this. And I'll call her back. Anyway, J-Bo, that's who I am. And we're talking here. This is my seventh consecutive podcast. And tonight, I just want to... I don't know. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the way that when I was 20 years old, and it's basically because I didn't have any major talking points. I don't want to talk about the news. It's fairly depressing, and I can't help being partisan, really. I have a hard time being objective, and I just don't feel like talking about it. There was a shooting and a bombing, and I mean, maybe I'll talk about it later, but really... I wanted to get away from all that bullshit and politics and just tell you fine folks how I made it to Seattle. Why does it fucking matter why I made it to Seattle? I never made it famous. I never did massive, amazing things in Seattle. But I lived a life. I was there for 20 years. And there were steps that took me there. And it's just my story. And who gives a shit? But I'm going to tell you anyway. Because it's a free-flowing podcast. It's free-form. And the great thing about being free-form is it can go on forever. And I can do anything. Anything I want. Absolute freedom. I love freedom, man. Boy, do I love freedom. I love freedom so much that I'm trying to go be free this Friday. It's my birthday. And I'm going to go to Detroit. I'm going to wake up at 4:30 in the morning. Have a breakfast packed, a hearty breakfast, and leave by 5. And I'm going to get into Detroit by 9:30. It's 4.5 hours from where I will be Thursday morning, which is Greensburg, Pennsylvania. And I've always wanted to go to Detroit. If you guys are regular listeners to the show, you know that. And why do I want to go to Detroit? I don't know. It just seems like a badass city. There's some amazing music there. The Detroit Cobras, there's, you know, Jack White and all his projects, you know, the Henchmen, Iggy Pop is from Detroit, terrible Ted Nugent, you know, Ted White and Blue, who I definitely respect. That dude runs his mouth, and anybody who runs his mouth that much in a political climate that we have, I appreciate, you know. He likes to hunt as well. You know, I eat meat. I guess I would like to hunt. It's not so much that I would like to hunt, but I feel like if I eat meat, I should hunt. And man, if you listen to a Ted Nugent podcast and you listen to him for 2 hours, like the one he did with Joe Rogan, you have a total appreciation for that dude and just his hunting skills and his musical skills. Anyway, I want to go to Detroit. I'll quit talking about terrible Ted. But Eminem's from Detroit. Detroit at one point apparently was as big a city as America had ever seen. Apparently, like, bigger than Los Angeles. Booming economy. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but apparently it's fucking wrecked now. It's totally wrecked and totally fucked up. But with those kind of cities, the skeletons bear some kind of cool culture that I can be a part of, I guess, at least for a day on my birthday. I'm going to go down there Friday. To be honest, I just want to drink some hipster coffee, and I want to maybe look at some record stores, the things white boys do, you know what I mean? I'm not going to get too hardcore into the, let's say, urban culture or the burnt down areas or the parts that I've heard that you shouldn't ever get out of your vehicle or you shouldn't ever stop at the stop signs. I just want to go in the daytime and I want to see what it's all about. Everybody says pretty horrible things about Detroit. I was in the airport and I've never been to Michigan except I've been to the airport. And I was in the airport and I was going to take the bus downtown and every local said, absolutely not, dude. Do not take that bus downtown. And I just pictured it happening. Me not knowing where to go, the bus not coming back to the airport, me having to get off the bus, find another bus stop across the street and come back. It may have been just fine. But when the locals say don't go, I didn't go. But this time, I'm going to do a little research. And I'm going to go to a city I've never been to for my birthday. That sounds like freedom to me. That sounds fucking awesome. And I'll have something to tell you the next podcast we have, which should be coming out next Tuesday. So anyway, how I got to Seattle. Well, when I grew up, and you went to high school when I went to high school, which was 91, 92, 93, and 94, there was a little something called grunge that happened. Grunge was basically four bands, at least the way I knew it, and at least the way most mainstream types know it to this day. You had Soundgarden, you had Pearl Jam, you had Nirvana and Alice in Chains. Alice in Chains was like harder, dark-edged heavy metal. Soundgarden was like grinding 70s screaming rock. Nirvana was three-piece and not a lot of, you know, lead solo-y stuff from a guy that didn't play in a traditional fashion, although I loved Kurt Cobain's solos. I really did. His solo in a song like In Bloom just blows me away. I'd rather listen to that than any virtuosic guitarist almost, you know. At least I'd rather listen to that as much. Not rather, but just as much as any guitarist. It's atonal, but it's melodic, and he made it up and he learned it, and it wasn't just random because he plays it the exact same way every time live, and it's brilliant. Anyway, so Nirvana was a punk band, in essence. Punk meaning freedom, punk meaning do whatever you want, and just very natural. I was listening, I guess why I started thinking about this today was I was listening to Nirvana this morning. I was listening to Incesticide, and I was thinking how good that band really was. In a lot of ways, I think they were amateurish, you know? Because I think a three-piece, and with the way Cobain played guitar, it was a little, I don't know, it was a little non-sophisticated in a way, you know? Especially, I don't know how to describe what I'm saying, but they had massive potential, and they reached their potential. Obviously, they're a super famous band, but either way, I'll skip that part and I'll get to me listening to Incesticide. Incesticide is brilliant. It's totally brilliant. And you realize, wow, this guy was doing this shit when he was about 19 years old, maybe 20, like a young guy. And the voice is so sophisticated and so like rich and so confident. And the guitar is brilliant. And the bass and the drums. You fast forward to Nevermind, and it was more of a pop thing, and he almost like limited himself in a sense to his creativity to just power chords and pop, you know? And so I don't know, Incesticide was blowing me away, like, my God. And the thing about Nirvana people may or may not realize is they specifically set out for like a certain sound every record, it seems like. You know, if you listen to Bleach, it's kind of that 70s sub-pop sound. Now, I don't know about you, but if I sat there and I moved to a big city and I had previously done kind of whack, noisy, discordant, Jesus lizard style music mixed with whatever, and all of a sudden I was like, well, this is the type of music that Seattle is playing, and so I'm going to write a record full of these songs. Well, he writes a record in the style of what's happening in Seattle at the time, because if you listen to his stuff before that, it didn't sound much like Bleach. And he does it so well, it's like a totally classic record. It's, I believe, the first or second, I think it's the first top-selling sub-pop record. Second would be Postal Service, Give Up, I think it's called. But to understand that Kurt Cobain was attempting to write in a certain style to please the Seattleites, and please the Seattleites he did. And then he's like, oh, I want to move over and I want to try my hand at pop music, because we just signed. Who the fuck could do that? Who's just going to try their hand at pop music and write this like legendary record that's 12 songs of pop perfection? There's only a couple duds, and they're not even duds. The duds on Nevermind are like the best song most people will ever write. And then In Utero was slightly uneven, but it worked so well as a whole, and it was so kind of dark and corrosive has been used. Anyway, you can tell that I know a little bit more about Nirvana than I do Soundgarden, Pearl Jam. Anyway, I digress. If you're going to, I digress in a big way, but that's what the shit show is all about, isn't it? Digression. Tangents. And, okay, so you're in high school, these four bands, you can't help, you're in high school in the between 91 and 94, and you can't help but be totally inundated by this grunge music. And to be honest, I had Pearl Jam 10, I saw Soundgarden open for Guns N' Roses, I saw Alice in Chains, I didn't mention Pearl Jam and the Big Four. I mentioned Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam 10 is an amazing record. Those guys live pulled it off perfectly. And the musicality of Pearl Jam is slightly underrated, I think. But that first record, the things they're doing melodically, totally like symphonic guitar rock. Unbelievable. And you can see some of the early footage of Pearl Jam. And it's so undeniable, so crazy what they did at like Pain in the Grass in about 91. And, you know, Pearl Jam sprung from the ashes of Mother Love Bone. And I was not a fan of Mother Love Bone, although I didn't know about them till much later. I thought they were, I don't know, man. I wasn't into it at all. But they definitely scored a great lead singer with Eddie Vedder after Andrew Wood had died, their previous lead singer. And obviously shot to the stars, but they were a brilliant band. We called them all grunge, but that was just a media label. I think there's stories of record labels like paying their bands to wear flannels and shit because it was all the rage, which is kind of funny because we regard those bands as just in total integral. But, you know, was Alice in Chains like a boy band? They weren't a boy band, but you know what I mean? Like they were put together in this grunge fashion. So really what I think of grunge actually came before all that. And I think grunge is more to do with like early Soundgarden, actually Tad and Mudhoney, those early sub pop bands are screaming, Jack and Dino produced just heavy, sludgy, real rock from the Northwest. I think it became commercialized and we got the Big Four: Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. So anyway, I did a yearbook spread in high school, and I remember the caption was like, "Say you want a revolution," and it said Seattle in like this kind of earthquake font, if I remember right. But I don't know why it never made it to the yearbook. I don't know if it was just cut out, left on the cutting room floor. I do remember that a guy had stolen a Nirvana promo picture. His name was Nick Graff. "You son of a bitch. It's okay, dude. I would have stole it too." But I don't know if that was the reason why we didn't actually do the Nirvana spread, or if I just dropped the ball or something. But it would have been great. There was going to be, in my like 1993 yearbook, there was going to be a big Seattle thing. So either way, I'd always kind of been enamored by the West Coast. And I decided when I was about 20 years old that I'm going to go to the West Coast. Partially, I wanted to see Seattle, but really, I wanted to see California. So literally, I set a date. I decided in the midsummer. I think I was inspired by a trip I took from St. Augustine to Nova Scotia with my friend Richard and Tony. And it just opened my eyes to the open road, and I was like, hell yeah. And I had gotten a little car for my graduation present, which I fucked up later. Real regretful, I guess. I ran it out of oil and just threw a rod. And yeah, man. Regrets, right? But so I set a date. I said, all right, in October, I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave Florida, and I'm going to drive out to California. And I talked to my buddy a couple weeks ahead of it. His name was Jason Lewis, and he said he'd go. He was like 17 at the time. He's a pretty young dude. I was 20. Yeah, I think I was 20. And I got two jobs. I worked at Hungry Howie's, and I worked at Gypsy Cab Company, where my stepdad owned. That was in St. Augustine, good old St. Augustine, Florida. A side note, the only job that Danny Auerbach of the Black Keys, by the way, who is my stepdad's first cousin's son, so basically like a nephew, the only job he's ever had, this is for the rock history books, was at that same restaurant, Gypsy Cab Company. He was like a dishwasher or a busser or something. So yeah, bona fide rock star coming through that joint. Anyhow, I had two jobs, and I saved up like, I don't know, $1,200, and I got a money belt. My mom made sure I had a money belt. You know, it's so funny, like some young guy driving around with like an old man's money belt on, you know? I figured somebody robs me, I don't know. When you go out on your own and you go out into uncharted territory, you always kind of think the worst. Like any long trip I've ever taken, it's always what I've envisioned was never like what it was. What it was always decent, and like there was a road and there was electricity and there was like sunshine, but what I pictured was just like dark and rain and just the abyss and people fucking with you and ripping you off, and it's never been that way for me. So I didn't need a money belt probably, because to this day nobody's ever robbed me. I mean, that was, you know, 23 years ago. Nobody's ever robbed me, so I never needed a fucking money belt, right? So anyway, I set sail, and every night we slept in my car. And back, you know, when I had money, every morning we had to have a nice breakfast. So me and Jason would like, you know, we said I think I said goodbye to my brother. It was my last stop, and then I ended up in fucking New Orleans and hung out with this woman who we went to high school with, and she was so happy to see us. It was kind of funny. So happy to see us that night because she was drunk. But the next morning I realized, oh, this woman just has a drinking problem, because she came out and she literally just goes, what are you guys going to do today? Because you can't stay here. And I'm like, oh, you were so nice the night before. What the hell? Anyway, that was fucking weird. I don't even remember her name, but yeah, she had done one of my buddies wrong in a Mardi Gras trip, so fuck her, for sure. Anyway, whatever. We end up just crashing every, you know, we drive 8 hours a day, 10 hours, 12 hours a day, and just crash. We crashed in New Orleans. We crashed in New Braunfels, Texas at this bed and breakfast. We crashed at Roswell, New Mexico, and every night I had this, like, nervous feeling, but it was being overcome by this, like, hopeful and this amazing, like there's something on the horizon feeling. And it was just really cool. And by the halfway through my trip, you know, we stayed in the car about 10 or 11 nights. I was totally cool, and I felt good. I felt confident. And I remember getting to California. I was like, fuck yeah, California, and seeing a Hollywood Video sign. And I remember thinking, wow, we're in Cali, man. That's Hollywood Video. That's really cool. And I saw the Pacific Ocean for the very first time in, I think it's called like Golden Cliffs or something like that in San Diego. And that was a real moment for me. Just the West Coast. I'd always wanted to see the West Coast. And to be, you know, I'd always seen the East, the Atlantic Ocean. And as I looked north, the ocean would be to my right. Now, on the West Coast, as I looked north, the ocean is to my left. And that was a big deal to me. I don't know, because I grew up around the ocean in St. Augustine. And it was just, it was so fresh and so new. I was 20 years old and everything was just an adventure. I stayed in San Diego a little bit, made my way up to San Francisco, got a bunch of parking tickets, ended up living in a hostel. And the hostel was called the India House, and that was great. Met very cool people, got super drunk. I would like go up to the Cala Foods and put a Jägermeister thing down my pants and bring back and just fuck everybody up at the hostel with and get them all drunk, at least my buddies, and you know, shooting fireworks off the roof down at people, I don't know, making out with girls on the roof. Just unbelievable memories, and it was just so fresh. And you know, put on eyeliner and Hawaiian shirts, and just I was so free. And San Francisco has such a great energy, and the wind, I just remember the wind, something about the wind in San Francisco just blew me away. And it was just so beautiful, man. Let your freak flag fly. I was playing a lot of guitar in the hostel, a bunch of us were. I learned how to play Blackbird one night. I used to make food for the hostel. It was just a real fucking amazing time. And I remember on my way to San Francisco, I was actually reading Jack Kerouac. And we got into San Francisco just as I had read in the book that he got to San Francisco. It was the book On the Road. And that book, I mean, don't read it if you're tied down to some bullshit. Read it if you're on the road. And you will get the feeling that you will get this unbelievable, undeniable feeling of just being free. And it's so cool. I mean, it's such a great book. Apparently, he did it in like 4 days, high on Benzedrine or something like that. I was really into the Beat Poets. And I was in San Francisco for about 3 months, maybe 2 or 3 months. And it seemed like an eternity. I have this theory that we can actually change the way we relate to time as humans. Meaning, and if you can follow me, let's say you are a manager at McDonald's and you're comfortable and you have a little house and a little family and stuff like that. And the days go by real quick, right? And it's the same day over and over and over, right? It's like a tire, just the same day over and over and over. And before you know it, a year seems like it takes a month. You know, the more years that go by as you get older, basically, time kind of just speeds up. It's really weird. But I think it speeds up because we're living the same day over and over, right? It's kind of an interesting thought. Like, we're living the same day over and over because we're, you know, busy preparing our nest egg for death, you know, and for our retirement. But I think the trick is to make your life bigger and better and take longer is to actually do a whole bunch of new things, throw yourself into a new city. You know, those 2 months I spent in San Francisco, it felt like, when I think back to those times, it felt like 6 months. It felt like a year practically. But then the last 5 years I spent in Seattle felt like 1 year, you know, because everything was new in San Francisco. Maybe it was because I was younger too. But then in Seattle, the last 5 years was very formulaic, very much bullshit, very much the same Groundhog's Day over and over, and your life slips by you. Basically. So I don't know. I think we should all try very new things, throw ourselves into new situations because it will take so much longer, you know? So I was in Frisco, like I said, 2 or 3 months, and I got a bunch of parking tickets and I actually had to leave. And I think my mom, thank you, Mom. I think she ended up paying them. That's what she said. And I appreciate that. But anyway, I left San Francisco. It's an amazing city. Who knows what would have happened if I had stayed? Who the fuck knows, right? Like, I could have stayed there. But I left because I had too many parking tickets. And I wanted to see Seattle. And so I drove up in 1 day from, like, San Francisco to Oregon. I think we stayed the night in Oregon, me and my buddy. Portland, Oregon. And I don't remember too much about Portland that night other than... No, I don't remember anything about it, actually. But the next day we went up to Seattle and I didn't know what to expect, but we rolled past Seattle, and I remember thinking, is that it? Well, that must be it. There's the Space Needle. How do we get there? Now we're in the University District. We just drove past the city. And I don't know. What's the fucking first thing we did in Seattle? We probably found a hostel. I remember finding a bank, maybe getting some cash, and I don't know that I had a debit card back then. Yeah, I must have found a bank. Get some cash and went to a hostel and found a few like-minded individuals somehow. We roomed with a guy named Aaron Krantz, who I know to this day, a guy named Rob Hamilton, myself, and Jason Lewis. And it was kind of like us four in this hostel room. And it was kind of like us against the rest of the hostel. I remember, you know, kind of breaking in, although the door wasn't locked, into another person's hostel. And they had all these like milk jugs. There were these glass milk jugs, and they were worth like 75 cents a piece. He had about six of them. So I took them up to the store and sold them. And you know, that's how broke I was. And I would get free lunch from this place called Larry's Market. And basically it's one of those deals that you go up to the deli counter and you get some couscous and you get maybe a sandwich and a couple things and you go eat it. Then you just throw it away. You know, they're very generous. It's like the grocery store doesn't want to give you the illusion that they're sweating it. They're sweating money, so they kind of just are fine with people stealing shit to give the illusion that that they're rich and they don't need the shit, you know, so you can take the shit for free. Maybe that's not how they think, but that's how I looked at it. So I lived in a hostel for, I don't know, four or five months, and there were these Swedish girls there. And they would always brag about themselves and say, we are so hot, and of course you like us. And who could blame? I remember they would always say, who could blame? And I was so young, I didn't realize, but dudes were just getting down with those chicks all the time. The hostel life was crazy. There was a guy named John from Australia who would make a train wreck every night. And what that was, he would reach in the refrigerator and just kind of grab a handful from everybody's shit and throw it into a pot and cook it up. And that's what he would eat every night. And it was all so fresh. And the very first thing when we got to that hostel was a guy who looked like about a 65-year-old Kurt Cobain-style guy with a red flannel and just scruff. And I think he realized that we were like enamored by him. Like, man, this is a real Seattle old school man, real old school Seattle guy. And he played us a song, and it was about suicide. And I thought, wow, man, this really is the suicide capital of the world. Other memories from that time, going to Kurt Cobain's house and seeing Courtney Love at the fountain, seeing her daughter, Frances Bean, and thinking it was them. But as I approached to say hi, Courtney shot me a look. And I remember thinking, well, that's not them at all. I shouldn't go up to them at all. That's not them. And I always wonder if she was throwing some Jedi mind shit on me, some, you know, like through the power of her mind, letting me know that that wasn't her. But it really was, because 2 weeks later in Rolling Stone, I saw pictures of them at the same park wearing the same leopard skin print. And I was right there, but somehow I didn't think it was them walking up to them as Courtney Love looked at me. So I don't know. That was interesting. How I ended up staying in Seattle was my buddy Aaron Krantz, the guy at the hostel. We played guitar together and we started writing songs. And he's still a really good musician. And he wrote some badass songs. And we had a little set, you know. We kind of thrown it together. And he just wanted to be in a band, and so did I. Kind of my intention was kind of just play some music when I went out to Seattle. And I remember he had a song called Your Pussy Is My Church. And I could, if I had a guitar here, I could play it for you. I thought it was really good at the time. And I still do, actually, very simple, just a couple chords. But his lyrics were, your pussy is my church. It's where I go to worship. All of those things that are good about my life. I know I'm not the first to attend your service. Let the choir sing an homage to your thighs. And that was like our favorite song that we played. And I think he wrote it, but it was hilarious. He was a real ladies' man. You know, he loved women and he had skills, man. He was a couple years older than me, and I always appreciated his skills. But what I didn't realize is all dudes kind of get skills once they get a little older. Do you know what I mean? But he had the skills and I didn't. He was like 24. And that's a big difference when you're that age, you know. I was 20 or 21. I guess I was 21 by this point. But anyway, I got into drugs a little bit. I experimented. You know, I did some acid in the forest or the rainforest. That may have been later, but let's just say for the sake of the story that it was around this time. I also tried some harder drugs. Like I tried crystal meth. And I know people just hear that and they think, oh my God. You know, but it's like, give me a fucking break. You know, I can try things. I don't have an addictive personality like that where, I don't know, I felt it was safe to me. And I worked at I got a job as I was living in that hostel at, Time Life Libraries, and I became a telemarketer. And there was a lot of crystal going around there. And this girl named Sarah was a dealer. And I was one of the only people with a car, so I drove her to the dealer's house. And she would, like, break open a line on a CD, and we would do it up a couple times. But either way, the reason why I'm saying this, at one point, me and Aaron did drugs. I think he was tripping on acid, and I was on crystal. And we ended up at a Denny's restaurant in the morning. And this was the moment that I decided to stay in Seattle, and the moment that kind of led me to being there for 20 years, for better or for worse, right? It's a big statement, for better or for worse, 20 years in Seattle. This was the moment. And you might attribute it to drugs. You might attribute it to crystal methamphetamine and LSD. But we were high at a Denny's, and Jason Lewis, the guy who went out there, was sitting across the bench from us, and me and Aaron were just like kind of debating and talking and philosophizing about life and about art and about music and in a Denny's booth. And we got there about 6 in the morning, and it was probably 11 or 12 by the time we left in the afternoon. And I remember thinking, my God, the manager came over and he's like, could I ask you guys to leave? Because we have lunch coming in. And I looked at my clock and 4 or 5 hours had passed. And I really couldn't fucking believe it. It was crazy that much time. But that's what happens when you get high. It's like a time trap, a time warp. We must have talked for literally 3 or 4 hours. And at one point, I don't remember exactly how it went, but he asked me to join a band with him. And I must have been just vulnerable enough or something. Or I don't know. Vulnerable is the wrong word, but I don't know that I would have agreed to it sober, to be honest. But right then and there, I decided, okay, let's play some music, man, you know? And I called my mom that day and said, hey, could you ship out my Marshall cabinet and my amplifier and my guitars? And, you know, she was very sweet to do it, but it was probably $300 or $400 easy. And I remember it coming into like some post office or postal, and I didn't have a, wait, did I have a car? My car actually might have been destroyed by that point, because at some point I fucked up my car and I didn't have a car anymore. I don't think I did. Actually, I might have. It doesn't really matter. But I remember cracking open the guitar and the amp and all the popcorn. I remember the green popcorn was blowing all around the Seattle streets. And there it was. I had my guitar, my amp. I had my equipment. And it was heavy as shit, and I guess I was staying in Seattle at that point. And me and Aaron started rocking and rolling and started playing with a couple people. We started a band called Room 11 that people who remember that band remember it fondly. It was kind of like Sonic Youth meets Black Sabbath or something. It was kind of heavy, but it was pretty psychedelic, and we were all very unlearned individuals, and we were very experimental in those early days, you know, down like detuning the guitar and a lot of harmonics and noise. And we had a set, and I have very fond memories of that first little band, kind of being drunk on power with some of the songs. And the classic lineup was a girl named Autumn and a girl named Jen, myself and Aaron. And as the story goes, I ended up getting it on with Autumn and then getting it on with Jennifer. It was very, very incestuous situation. And then Jennifer had sex with Autumn's boyfriend that they had just like broken up with. And so Autumn hated Jennifer. And Autumn wanted to fight Jennifer during practice, and they would, like, glare at each other, and I had literally had to, like, stand between them while we were jamming. And it was a big scene, and me and Aaron decided it was the best idea to kick Autumn out of the band because she was causing trouble. But the fact is, she was a very big part of that band, and she, the way she looked, the way she played, which was terrible, really. But we were kind of a terrible band with flashes of brilliance. We never recorded a thing. We tried, but it was after Autumn had left. And it was just my first band, pretty much, my first band experience. They were called Room 11, and then it fizzled. Whatever, man. It fizzled, and me and Aaron remained friends. And then I started singing full-time myself and doing this whole other bunch of music, which we will get to at another day, okay? So that's basically the story. I don't know if you got anything out of that. I feel like I'm just rambling, but if you hear the warmth in my voice, if it made sense to you, I'm glad. If it didn't, I'm sorry, but thanks for coming this far, you know? And maybe next week I will tell you what happened after Room 11. The other projects I was in, and how they went, and how they eventually dissolved. Anyway, this has been the Shit Show with J-Bo. I don't know how long I've been doing this. Hopefully 40 minutes. I always go for 40 minutes. And we'll see you next week. Next week I will tell you about my Detroit trip. But we'll get the timeline with my music, because somebody's got to fucking hear about it. And somebody's got to talk about it. And that somebody is me, because I lived it. All right. This is the Shit Show with J-Bo. We shall talk soon. Have a beautiful week. I'll see you next Tuesday.